Morsell to O'Connell. O'Connell with 1 second. Left wing three on the way. Banks it in. He got it. I don't believe it. It's good. It's good.
If you want to have culture, come to Raleigh. The boys of Blues don't know about it.
Because we still hungry. And when we hungry, we eat.
It's going to be a great night. Turn the red light on, Chancellor Woodson. Go Pack.
Welcome back to another episode of the Lockcast from Trinity Road Times, where we have Trey, Alec, and Assad with us this week. Joel not able to be here this week. I know he was really looking forward to talking about the Final Four, though, which is what we're going to talk about first. Let's just get right into it. Obviously, one of the biggest weekends maybe ever in the history of NC State athletics. Unfortunately, neither team was able to bring home the hardware, but it certainly was a journey that I think NC State fans will look back on forever as one that was truly special and truly heartwarming in every way. And we've talked about that a little bit. I'm going to ask Assad first, though, for your thoughts on those two games. Because for me, you know, it felt like the women had a chance and one bad quarter and it got away from them. And for the men, just couldn't hit a shot.
Yeah, for the women, it really seemed like they were hanging in there, but I think that South Carolina's dominance was more inevitable than anything else, and it was really more about them exerting their will on that game than NC State. You know, they played a bad quarter, but you have to give credit to the just terrific defense and hustle that South Carolina plays with. You know, they are really well coached, and they know exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and they are going 100% on every single play. And they're just tall and long, and ultimately it was something that we thought was going to be an issue in the men's game was more of an issue in the women's game, because the NC State women just didn't have the size to compare with South Carolina, and that's ultimately what sunk Iowa in the championship game. For the men, it's something that everyone said going into it. You know, Zach Edey is just going to eat them alive, blah, 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 and all that stuff. And as he's done during this entire 10-game stretch, including the loss, the 9-game win streak, plus the loss in the Final Four, Kevin Keats came with an, you know, immaculate game plan. He came with the recipe of how to just disturb Zach Edey and disturb his, you know, his process, and got him off schedule. For a guy that's been tearing it up, getting 30 plus in every tournament game, and putting up numbers that haven't been seen since, you know, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and like big names like Oscar Robertson, and, you know, things that legendary players in the NCAA tournament that, you know, types of like 30 and 15 games and 40 point games in the tournament. To hold him to only 20 meant that the guys around him were ultimately going to need to make plays, and that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, so they did have a good plan for Edey. I thought they did a really good job with that situation. He was going to score, obviously. That was going to happen. But, you know, I thought that they did it right. Edey is, to me, like, it's not that impressive of a basketball player skill-wise. Like, his size makes what he does a lot easier for him. And he does have decent touch. He has a good, you know, a good hook shot. But he doesn't have a whole lot more to his game than that. And one thing that I think you noticed, I think Kevin also noticed it, you know, from tape, is he's not particularly strong with the basketball. And so you got in this rhythm State was in where, you know, they weren't doubling in the post. You know, they were single covering him, and you know, basically he was going to score in the 20s somewhere. But they did a really good job just digging at the basketball and swiping at it, and then, you know, recovering. And they actually forced 6 turnovers, which if you gave me that number before the game, I would have thought State was going to win. The official number was actually 5, but one of them was a bullshit foul call, and I think Jaden Taylor, that should never have been called. But yeah, they did a really good job making him uncomfortable with that. They gave up a couple of threes, which I think, you know, those were shots that were going to come inevitably. You know, if you're gonna send someone at the ball the way that they did. But I thought they defended that really well. I thought that game plan worked for him really well. I mean, they forced a good number of turnovers. I don't think you can really expect to stop Zach Edey from making shots. You could stop him from taking shots. And I thought that was something they did a decent enough job with. You know, Purdue and Marquette, two of the best offenses in America, scored 58 and 63 points against NC State. You know, these were teams that scored in the 80s and 90s and into the hundreds in this tournament. So really, I thought State was great on that end of the floor. They were horrible on the other end, and that's what sunk them. And you know what? I don't think it had anything to do with O'Connell's absence. It was mostly just a bad shooting game, or in a game where you knew you weren't going to get a ton of points and a ton of input from DJ Burns. Right? You know, when you get that ED matchup with Burns, Purdue's not going to double, and he's going to have more of an ability to slow down Burns one-on-one than any other big in America. And so when you build your team around that concept when Burns is in the game and they're able to slow that down, what Purdue is also doing defensively with a guy who's that big but frankly moves like a cruise ship is they're playing drop coverage on every screen. So when you factor those two things together, right, a low input from Burns that you expect to have and then drop coverage everywhere, but what that means is that State's going to have to depend on the zoom action. They're going to have to depend on the ball screens more, and they're going to have a big game in the mid range from DJ Horn. Horn was 8 for 21 from the field, which is not good enough. And they got nothing from Jaden Taylor or Casey Marcel. So that's basically where it sunk. You know,
literally nothing from Casey Marcel.
Yeah, literally zero, which, you know, Casey Marcel's been a tough matchup for people. You know, he's not a guy that can really get to the rim, but he's big for a guard. He can create some size mismatches and he can score over people. And that, you know, that's been a good like late shot clock bailout thing that they've done, but you got nothing from that. And then the big thing for me was Horn not having a great shoot. You needed a super game from Horn. You needed him to shoot at a very, very high efficiency in this game, and he didn't. And it's asking a lot of the guy, but that's what you had to have, I think, to win this game, because those were the shots that you were going to be able to get to. And I think with Horn, those are the shots you want, because he can make them, and he's proven it time and again, and that's actually what State's been trying to get to offensively for a long time with him. You know, through the DHOs and the, you know, the staggered screens and the zooms and stuff like that. And they got to him, but you just missed him. And to me, like, that's pretty much all it comes down to, is, you know, they just didn't make those shots. And then on the women's side, a lot of people just wanted to tip their cap to South Carolina, which, like, is fine. I mean, they were obviously the better team. I did not think State played super well in this game, particularly Sanaya Rivers, who's a player that I think had to have a big game, right? Because we talk about a similar situation to Purdue. You have a monster inside South Carolina, right? You have a skyscraper. So you're going to struggle to score at the rim. Those mid-range shots become really important in a game like that. And that's something Sanaya Rivers can make at a high clip. But you had to have a big game from the guards. It was the only way to have a chance. And if you make those shots at a high clip, right, you can get into the last quarter with the game in reach. And then, you know, the natural variance, right, can be enough to put you in a position to win that game. Don't think State wins either way, because South Carolina shot the ball really, really well. And if they were going to do that, you probably weren't going to win. But they should have been in it more going into the fourth quarter. I really thought that that's a game that it should have been within reach for State. You know, all in all, it's a phenomenal weekend for the program. That's just kind of my read on those two games.
Yeah, I think, you know, talking about the women's game first, when it was, you know, they were down at the half 1 point, and I was like, you know, I'll take that. I'll take that any day. I mean, South Carolina is a unit. They're in more than a team. They're a unit. And yeah. And they are hard to stop. And I really, really like Dawn Staley. I think she's a phenomenal coach and a phenomenal person. And she knew exactly. Same thing happened in that Iowa game. I mean, look at the Iowa game too, the national title game. Same thing happened at the start of the second half. They came out and they blitzed Iowa to start the second half. And maybe that's just their identity, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, what do they say? F around and find out? Well, did we F around and find out? I don't know. But, you know, South Carolina clearly figured something out at halftime of both of those games, and that's why they're national champs. On the men's side, you know, I agree with everything you guys said. I thought it was outstanding defensive game plan by Kevin Keats. And I remember saying last week, I thought State should put Middlebrooks on Edie because I thought Middlebrooks would defend Edie better, and that's kind of what they did, really. I mean, Burns got into foul trouble for it to happen, but
yeah,
they put Middlebrooks on Edie, and it kind of worked. Middlebrooks forced a few turnovers, and they really locked Edie down in the second half, which was exactly what they needed to do. Problem was they couldn't hit any shots, like we talked about, and I think that having, you know, your best shooters not shooting well is tough. And, you know, like Alec mentioned on our Twitter account, Michael O'Connell was 16 for 31 from three in the NCAA tournament. So I will disagree with you a little bit on that. I think if he was healthy, he probably does make a little bit of a difference in that game, and that game's at least closer.
So I will comment on, so O'Connell's been an interesting thing for me in the tournament, because statistically, if you look at what he's done, he's more or less been the same player as he was in the regular season outside of his perimeter shooting. So O'Connell's always moved the ball well for State, right? He's always been timely in passes on pick and roll and all the different ball screen sets that State runs. He's done a good job facilitating through that. He's not a guy who scores at the rim. So in the tournament, not the tournament, the postseason as a whole, all 9 games, all 10 games, he was 7 for 13 at the rim. So he doesn't put a lot of pressure on the rim. He was 8 for 22 from the mid-range, so he didn't do a whole lot there. But he was 16 of 31 from 3 in these games. So 28% three-point shooter during the regular season. 51% three-point shooter in the tournament. So that is really where he elevated his game as a scorer. It doesn't always seem that way because he hit some big-time shots at the rim, but he hit a very low volume of them. They're very high difficulty. He shot the lights out from 3, and of those 16 makes, 15 of them were assisted. 6 of them directly from DJ Burns. A couple of them were hockey assists from Burns. So what he really was as a scorer in this tournament was a beneficiary of the DJ Burns sets and DJ Burns' ability to pass the basketball. And he was a floor spacer as a scorer. Now, he had a lot of assists. I think he had a really nice passing game against Virginia. Like, he moved the ball well, but he's done that all year. The scoring lift mostly came as a spot-up shooter. And when you look at Purdue, you say, you know, most of these spot-up shots that you're taking off of these burn sets are coming off of doubles, right? They're coming off of rotations where guys are able to get open, where they're you know, sagging inward. State hit a couple hammer screens to him. I think one of them was in the Purdue game in the corner. So they have some sets like that. But when you don't have to double Burns, when you get Edie on Burns and he can cover himself, those opportunities start to dwindle. And so does the pick and roll stuff that O'Connell can really do, because he's more of a distributor. He's more of a guy that will pocket pass the ball to Ben Middlebrooks, who will go score at the rim. That dries up too when you have a 7'4" guy protecting the rim who never comes out of the paint. So that's why I go back to my original point about that game, is you really needed a monster game from DJ Horn from the mid-range, because those were the shots that you were going to be given by Purdue. So I don't think O'Connell's absence affected this as much as people think it does, because how he affected the game more is something that kind of wasn't a huge component against a team that does what Purdue does with the personnel that Purdue has. But definitely, like, still really noteworthy, that shooting performance. And, you know, 15 of those 16 shots were assisted. I think you guys probably remember the one that was not. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean, it literally is what started the run. I mean, we wouldn't even be talking about what we're talking about today if that shot didn't go in. So
the biggest difference for O'Connell was that he just had dry ice in his veins. I don't know how else to explain that. I mean, you know, we talk about the statistics as a whole, but the guy hit huge shots in this tournament. There's like nothing you can. That's not measurable. That's just, dude's got stones, and he does. And big deal.
I think it's also, like you're saying, how so many of them came off of assists. It's just that the ball wasn't sticking during this whole run. So, you know, the ball was moving constantly, looking for the open man. That's not what they were doing in the Purdue game, and maybe that was a factor of the defense that Purdue was playing. But it was really something that we hadn't seen in the regular season. And, you know, the complaints that people had about the offensive flow seemingly changed overnight once they switched into the postseason, in terms of how the ball was just moving constantly from one person to the other. And looking for the open look, and that's really an area that Jaden Taylor helped elevate. And, you know, anybody that was getting open shots, it was because somebody else had helped to contribute to them. You know, so they got open looks in the Purdue game. I think maybe there might have been a little bit of rushing those open looks, because a few times they rushed some shots and maybe they were surprised that they were so open and then rushed. And then the, you know, I've talked a lot about how guys have been able to hit shots once they've really been able to like really set themselves to shoot. And whenever the guys have been rushing their shots, it hasn't really worked out for them. So, but also it seemed like once they got into like the last 8 to 10 minutes of the game, there seemed to be sort of this air of inevitability about the game, and they weren't flying around with the same passion that they had been throughout the rest of the games. And you could kind of see the look on DJ Burns' face, like really like in the last like 5 minutes of the game or so, he kind of seemed like he had mentally checked out a little bit. So then a lot of the pundits were like, yeah, they ran out of gas. And it's not that they ran out of gas, like they were tired. I think that they, you know, mentally had sort of just allowed themselves to not think that they were really going to win that game. But, you know, ultimately, like you're saying, it's a great moment for the program and both programs and the school at large. I would expect undergrad applications to skyrocket. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens anytime. Yeah. You know, a relatively newcomer comes to the Final Four, a fresh face, and it causes renewed interest or just new interest in general. You know, it's the kind of thing where I've been living in New Jersey for nearly 20 years now, and most of the time people don't know what NC State is until now. And, you know, I've
just happened to me this week.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Yeah. I've been wearing NC State sweatshirts this whole time that I've been living here, but now that I'm here, you know, people that know me have been coming up to me all week, and anytime I see someone I haven't seen them in a week, oh I'm sorry, it's almost as if they're like giving their condolences to me. I'm sorry for your loss. But it's like they were rooting for NC State, everybody was, and it's the it's this new feeling that they wanted DJ Burns to continue to be successful. You know, we've never seen this before, not just making it to the Final Four, but this whole, you know, as Gary Hahn said it, this wave that turned into a tsunami, that this momentum that they were riding, and it was in that wave was everyone in America really wanting them to take down all these giants. It would have been really crazy if they'd made it to the championship game. I don't think ultimately anybody could have beat UConn.
I was going to say,
I would have loved to have seen it. You know, I think ultimately that game was kind of boring, and I didn't really watch very much of it.
I didn't watch a second of it.
Yeah, I turned it on when literally there was 90 seconds left in the game, and I was like, I don't need to even watch the highlights. I'm gonna, but it's, you know, it's.
Well, here's a question for you then. In that regard, it's a 2-part question. Part one of that question is if either NC State team had won, would they have won the national title? I don't think the men would have, but could the women have won the national title if they'd beaten South Carolina? I mean, hindsight's 20/20, obviously, of course. That's the first part of the question. Second part of the question is, can we not play the men's Final Four in 80,000-seat football stadiums anymore? Oh, like, God. I know people who were there who flew out to Glendale for the game and couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you think, the second part of that question, so the question is in two parts. Part one, would either of these NC State teams have won the national title if they had won, obviously knowing that hindsight's 20/20. And then part two is, should we move the men's Final Four back to basketball arenas? Let's not go first.
So the women, I think they could have beaten Iowa. I'm not sure whether they would have or not. I think they definitely would have beaten UConn for the second time of the season. But I think that, you know, South Carolina really, they allowed Caitlin Clark to go off in the first half, but then kind of neutralized her after that. And, you know, there definitely would have had a shot. I would have taken NC State in that game. I would not have taken the men against UConn. You know, they have just constructed a juggernaut behemoth of a team that, you know, if that whole team could come back and continue to play year after year, I don't know who would have beaten them. Yeah. But well, yeah, I had, oh, go ahead.
That's it. And UConn's not going anywhere. I mean, Dan Hurley, I don't think he's taking the Kentucky job. So
no,
you know, they're not going anywhere. So,
yeah. And, you know, because I know we're going to talk about maybe some transfer portal stuff, and I'll bring UConn back up when we talk about it. But I think that the whole thing with the arenas is laughable. How it's makes the championship game and the Final Four just a TV product. I was getting photos of people that I knew that were at the game, and it was just like looking at it from a mile away. That you're basically watching the game on the big screen. You're flying all the way out there to watch the game on a 100-foot screen, and you know, I guess you're there for the vibes also, because the Pac fans did show out, which was really, really, really cool.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. The moment, because I don't think it ever really sunk in for me, and I didn't mean to cut you off aside, but the moment that really sunk in for me that we are actually doing this was when they shouted "Red" during the national anthem.
And
that's when it finally hit me that we were playing in the Final Four.
I rewound it twice to hear them yell "Home of the Wolfpack," and I like had my kids with me. That was a really memorable moment for me. Like that was like I got chills like hearing that.
I think that was the moment when I, because you know, I will admit that when they made the Final Four, there were some tears shed in my little one bedroom apartment. But I think the moment that it absolutely the tears were flowing is when they were singing the national anthem, and you can hear that little corner of the stadium saying "Red," and I just I knew, it's like, holy cow, we're actually here. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's something that I've literally been waiting my whole life for a moment like that, and to have, you know, national media guys are national media guys, and they are who they are, and you know, their analysis after the game was very like weak sauce, I think, of actually talking about why NC State had lost the game, but you know, just, you know, giving all of the flowers to Purdue, but just in general during this whole run and seeing people.
By the way, a little live reaction here. Kentucky has made a coaching hire, and it's not Dan Hurley.
Oh, well, no. How about that?
Or they're going to make a coaching hire. But
is it the BYU coach?
That's what it looks like. It's going to be the BYU coach, yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows? By the time you're listening to this, they could have switched, and it could be Kevin Keats for all we know. So the way this coaching search is going, we could have Julius Hodge coaching Kentucky tomorrow. I don't know. But,
but yeah, I mean, just in general, have all of these years of having State be either not talked about on the national stage or just dismissed or only talked about in terms of what they haven't done or where they've fallen short, and to have that whole narrative just flip on a dime like that, and people speaking positively about them, positively about the coach and the program and the school, you know, obviously we'll take this moment for what it is, and we can hope that they can turn this into momentum moving forward. But even if they don't, you know, we'll always have 2024. And I think Joe Giglio is the one that put it really succinctly. And, you know, he was saying that State fans never really wanted. People have assumed that they want to be Duke and Carolina just because they're in a tough neighborhood, quote unquote. But they just wanted, they just wanted to be respected. That's what we wanted. We wanted to be, you know, not to be laughable, that we can speak our name in the same breath as them, and that we wanted to have something that was our own, literally just something, you know, something that we could stop talking about 1983 and 1974 and just say, that this was something of our own. And, you know, I'm wearing my championship hat and shirts. I got a whole box of other gear that I bought. And, you know, it shows how much demand there was for the stuff that the student store, I emailed them like 2 weeks ago saying, like, I nicely worded email saying, like, please tell me where is my stuff? I ordered it. And they said they were backlogged with such a huge demand for orders that they're trying to get the stuff out as quickly as they can. And the order took so long that State won the ACC championship, made it into the NCAA tournament, and went all the way into the Final Four and played that game by the time my ACC championship gear arrived. And so it just came yesterday. So I'm still waiting for my final four gear. So they said it ships yesterday. So hopefully in the next few days I'll get that.
Well, Alec, your thoughts on those two questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think State could have beaten Iowa. I think State's a more complete team than Iowa, and I think they have, you know, a really strong perimeter defender in Saniah Rivers that could, you know, hold Caitlin Clark to 30 points or so. I think State could beat Iowa. I don't think the men could beat UConn, but I do think if Tennessee had beaten Purdue, State would have played UConn. I really do believe that the Purdue game was much more of a matchup issue than anything else that State, you know, really ran into. I think they could have handled the, you know, what Tennessee does pretty well, because, you know, a lot of what Tennessee does is really similar to what, you know, Oakland did with Jack Golkey, which State handled relatively well. I think that they could have been there, but UConn, man, yeah. I mean, that's a buzzsaw. I don't even know what you do about it. I mean, they're so good. And, you know, I don't think I wouldn't have picked anybody to beat them. And then, yeah, I mean, you know, I saw the pictures, too, from those stadiums. It's like you're sitting like you might as well watch it from the blimp. I mean, you can hardly see anything. It made me feel better about not going. Like, I want to go, but it's so expensive. And then you get the photographs and the pictures coming through, and it's like, I would have had to find room for my binoculars and my carry-on if I'd gone. Like, I'm not going to be able to see the basketball game, so,
you know. I mean, I had considered going, and then I was like, maybe I'll just go to Cleveland. If they beat South Carolina, maybe I'll just go to Cleveland. Mm-hmm. But I considered going, and I came within, like, a day of saying, okay, I'm going to buy tickets. But then I ended up realizing I'm playing in an 80,000 seat football stadium. I'm going to be higher up than most people are at concerts.
Like, the vibes were great for the women's game though, because that's an actual NBA basketball arena. And that crowd was great. The energy was great for both of those games, or all three of the final four games. And
I think my biggest question about all of this is, how did the NC State band pick who was going to Cleveland and who was going to Phoenix and who was going to the spring game?
Yeah.
Like, those are the biggest questions I have.
Yeah. I don't know. I can do some investigating on that. Actually, I don't know.
We need like an investigative like feature on these things.
There's this one girl that's in the band. Yeah. Actually, there's this one girl in the band that tweets a lot, and I've interacted with her a little bit on Twitter. Maybe I'll tweet at her and ask her.
Power Sound of the South, Decision Day, coming soon to Trinity Road Time.
Eye of Assad.
But that kind of leads into, you know, Assad had mentioned that going to the Final Four kind of puts a new light on NC State. And I think that moment, and one that people really don't think about, was a big recruiting win for NC State as a university as a whole, but was the outdoor hockey game last year for the Carolina Hurricanes. It was also a huge recruiting win for NC State because it was at their stadium. The band was there. They interviewed the football coach. But I think going to the Final Four is obviously a much bigger recruiting win than that. And the reason why I bring that up is because we've already made a big splash in the transfer portal, and there might be more to come. We don't know, but
There will be.
As of now, NC State may be making one of the bigger splashes in the transfer portal. Obviously, there's still a lot to figure out with the Arkansas-Kentucky situation, but what are your thoughts on Mr. Huntley Hatfield? We'll go with Alec first.
I'm a huge fan. I think he's a really, really good basketball player. I actually said this many times this year. I thought Louisville had good players and was just really poorly coached. And, you know, Huntley Hatfield is the prime example of that. He's a good basketball player. He is the prototypical role man in a four out, one in spread pick and roll offense, which I think is what State's going to revert more to next year because there's only one DJ Burns. So I think that's what you're really going to see. And I think they still have to, you know, stock some guards up here. But, you know, he's a really good player. He's huge. Right? He's 6'10". He may even be listed at 6'11". He's almost like, I almost compare him to like a better, more polished version of Ben Middlebrooks. Like, he's enormous. He has a pretty developed post game. You know, he's a good role man in pick and roll. He understands how to do that. And he has like a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a budding jump shot too. He's definitely a guy that can like extend baseline on a dribble drive and catch a pass and hit like a 10 footer, which is a nice thing to have. And he's shot a very low volume of threes, but he's not completely hapless from three. So, you know, if you can, you know, if you believe in that, and we said the same thing about Modiara, and he went through some really hot stretches. If you believe in that, you can sprinkle in some pick and pop in there as well. He's a guy that can roll and then post up, and you can feed him and he can score. Like, he's pretty well rounded as a you know, a post player, and he's a really good athlete too. So this should be a very, very athletic front court next year for Kevin Keats, and I would expect Huntley Hatfield to start and play 30 minutes a game because he's good. He's really good. And I'm really, really excited to have him because, you know, he's, you know, Diarra to me is, as an athlete, profiles as a five, but I don't think his skill set is there yet. I don't think he's enough of a post scorer to really operate as a five in pick and roll. Right? He's, to me, is, you know, he gets his points on offensive rebounds. He gets his points from three. So, you know, I don't think you can trust, you know, running him through all those sets as your primary screen and roll man. Because if he catches the ball in the low block, I don't think you have a lot of faith that he's going to score. But with Huntley Hatfield, you do. So you can expect to see Diarra at the four, Huntley Hatfield at the five. And that's a lot of size and a lot of athleticism. And possibly two guys over 6'10 that can shoot the basketball. Or Diarra might be shorter than that. I don't know. But tall guys, they're real tall. And that can shoot the basketball. I think it's 6'10". Possibly. So, you know, it's that is a Kevin Keats front court, if there ever was one. So that is really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's something where, you know, it's been frustrating over the years where it seemed like Kevin Keats just loves his guards. And, you know, he over-recruited that position for a long, long time. And I think one of the casualties of that, even just now, is Cam Woods transferring out, and plus the loss of MJ Rice and LJ Thomas. You know, but he has been allergic, it seemed like, to recruiting power forwards. And you can't really compete at the top of the ACC if you have no power forwards. And he really seemed like he was stuck for a long time of his mindset of the way that he wanted to play. And Alec, you mentioned it before, that he had a certain way that he wanted to play, but he had not recruited the players to play that style. And then eventually, this year, he was able to evolve and play to the style of the personnel he actually had on the roster, not of the roster that he wanted to have. Yeah. And so if he can get one high-scoring guard, basically you need a DJ Horn-like replacement, a high-scoring guard that's going to consistently get you 15 points a game but can go off for 25 on a given night, and pair those guys together. I know there's been a lot of debate in the last few days of whether O'Connell should come off the bench. I think having O'Connell, Diarra coming off, maybe Diarra coming off the bench, but I think Middlebrooks maybe as a starter is a nice situation. I don't know if you continue to bring in another transfer forward, but you know, Diarra / Middlebrooks starting with Huntley Hatfield and TBD guard. You know, I think that with O'Connell as the point, I think that's a pretty potent lineup if all of these guys stay, obviously, knock on wood, that core that made this run, the core of those three guys, O'Connell, DR, and Middlebrooks, hoping that none of them leave.
Yeah. I'm trying to find something here. Actually, Chris McDonald on Twitter tweeted out the average amount of experience per player of the top six guys each year under Keats. And next year's projection is 4.3. This year's was 4.5.
Yeah, they got old. Got, I mean, talent. They got experience. And you see that, right? I mean, it's you know, you mentioned O'Connell. Like, I think O'Connell's a pretty polished player, just, you know, with what his ceiling is. And You know, I think he should start, and I think he should be a starter for sure. But what I want to see from him is a continuation of the spot up shooting, and then I want State to pair him with, you mentioned, your DJ Horn replacement. Like, love Horn to death, but State needs a guy that can get to the basket a little bit more. And I think, you know, Ryan Conwell from Indiana State has visited now. That's a high pick for me because that guy can absolutely do that. I think if you can pair those guys together, and you have O'Connell as a guy who can still continue to make shots, right? You can space the floor with either one, and you can run your sets with either one. And then, you know, you're showing the defense a very, very different way of beating them, you know, repeatedly, you know, the same actions. And I think it really could make it hard. One of my complaints with Kevin Keats, especially during the late years of the Markell Johnson era, were that it was too easy for the defense to get into a rhythm defending someone like Johnson, right? Because when they ran these actions, and Saad, you mentioned, like, they didn't recruit bigs very well. Like, that's absolutely true. When they ran these actions with Wyatt Walker and, like, Manny Bates and players like that, that aren't great role guys, it was just way too easy to just hedge and recover. And teams just did that till they're blue in the face, and State didn't have a great answer for it. But I think, you know, you get a guy like O'Connell, you know, who isn't necessarily a guy that's gonna run around a hedge, that's gonna turn the corner on a hedge, but he can make passes out of it, right? And then you get a guy who can do that, like a Conwell or someone that can, you know, get to the basket and actually score at the basket, which State was missing dearly this year. You can run both of those guys. It doesn't matter who's technically the point guard at that point. You run actions with both of them, which State has done for years. You know, they did that with Horn and O'Connell this year. And so, you know, I think you're in a really good spot there with those two. And you like where you're at almost everywhere else. Like, you know, Jaden Taylor is, I think, a strong 3-and-D guy. He's a little inconsistent as a shooter, but he's definitely a great defender. And that's your 3. And then, you know, Diarra is your 4, and Huntley Hatfield's your 5. And I think Middlebrooks comes off the bench at the 5. And, you know, that's a really good rotation. And if you can just put in, you know, what you get 2 if you can, but, you know, you can get a guy like Conwell, right, who's a 41% shooter, and you can get to the basket and score over someone bigger than him. You can really, you can score and win games in a lot of different ways that way. And that's really exciting. I also, like, if you can, if you have space, like, I would love to get, like a 6'8", 4 man who could rebound a little bit and who can shoot the lights out. Like a Damari Monsanto type guy at Wake Forest who can shoot 40%. I always thought the perfect Keats 4 was Jack Clark if he could shoot. Jack Clark could not shoot. But a guy
that
could.
He's in the transfer portal again, by the way.
He is in the transfer portal again, which is crazy, yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I would love to have, but that's icing for me. You got to go out and you got to get one or two of these downhill paint touch guards. And I think Conwell is a good example of that. And we'll see who else is out there. I know they've had some other visits. They're talking to a lot of different, you know, prospects out there now, but they're on a really good path. They really are.
Yeah. And I mentioned the core of those other 3 guys, and I forgot to mention Jaden Taylor. Yeah. I'll be remiss to not give him his flowers for all of the really the influence that he put on the defensive end during the tournament runs. So yeah.
Yeah. And shooting.
As long as he stays.
Yeah, he got a lot of crap this year, I think, that was mostly undeserved. Mm-hmm. He was plugged into a role that wasn't really for him at times. He's not a paint touch guard. He's not quick off the ball. Like, that's just not who he is. I don't know. It seems like it's kind of became a thing that people thought he was. It's not really who he was. He settled into more of like a 3-and-D role, and I didn't pull the numbers on him like I did with O'Connell, but he shot close to 50% from 3, you know, down the stretch of the season into the postseason, and that's all they need from him. Defend and make 3s. And that's all you need from him. And, you know, I think if you can get that next year, you've got the right pieces coming together. If you can get some of those guards.
Once he stopped doing too much, then
right,
he
exactly.
settled down.
He was doing too much. Yeah, he was trying to get to the rim too much. He's not his game. You know, it was never his game.
And all right,
underrated loss, though, is going to be Casey Marcel, just in terms of on ball defense. So I don't know if they're gonna, it'd be hard to replace him, but I don't know, like, on the defensive end, who's gonna guard the other team's best guard. That will be a big question mark.
Actually, I did come up with one question. Are we concerned at all about transfer portal for the women's team?
They need to add some forwards.
In terms of losses?
Yeah. Like, is anybody going to leave? Are we worried about?
I don't think so. I think the only two people we'd be really, really worried about would be Azaia and Sanaya. And Sanaya seemed like she was re-upping in her most recent post. So, I think they'll probably be okay.
Yeah. Well, then my other question, and last one for basketball, and I almost mean this in a sarcastic way, not seriously, but do we still think Kevin Keats has an AAU offense?
Man, what a great year for that. Yeah. So we just talk about what he did with DJ Horn for a second and how good this player got managed. Because if you go back to the beginning of the year, you can do it. You can go back and read articles and you can even listen to like our podcast after like the first UNC loss. You know, the big hole with this team was they didn't have any ability to put pressure on the rim. We talked about these numbers all year. Like, these are not players. They don't have a single player on the team that could put pressure on the rim from the perimeter, a guard. And as the season like progressed, that didn't change, right? I think Horn did a little bit better job taking advantage of, you know, when those opportunities presented themselves, but he wasn't creating that very often. He was shooting threes and he was shooting mid-range shots, and he shot the lights out from the mid-range. He shot like 50% from that mid-range area, you know, 2-point shots away from the rim is the official metric according to Bart Torvik. And he was 43% on the season, but like the last half of the season, because remember he was 3-for-22 over a 2-game stretch at one point. he was really good, and it transformed the offense a lot because those are the shots that State could get, and they could get them regularly, right? If you isolate him on a switch, he can make those shots. You know, if you get him coming off of, well, one thing they did a lot was they really depended a lot on this zoom action, which, so for anybody who doesn't know, zoom action is you have a guard basically in the corner, you have a big around the slot, top of the key-ish area, typically more in the slot or on the wing, and then you have a second player in the middle that sets a down screen, and then the guy receiving the ball comes off the down screen and takes a dribble handoff and is supposed to curl to the basket. And they depended on that a lot because it really created opportunities for those mid-range floaters and mid-range pull-ups that Horn got really, really good at. That, to me, plus Burns really taking it up a notch. Those are excellent coaching pieces. You know, they took a player and they let him be him, and they coached to what he does well. They did not say, hey, DJ Horn, you have to go put pressure on the rim and shoot 40% of your shots at the rim. Because he would just get packed every third time because he's not very big. But they didn't do that, right? They coached around what he does well, and they designed actions and used actions to get him to do that. And they were really hard to guard because you can't cheat on those with a guy like Horn, right? You go underneath that down screen, he's just going to fade it back to the corner and make a three. And he'll just get a pass and make a three. It's really well designed for what they had. And, you know, it's like we talked about with the Purdue game. He had to make those mid-range shots because that's what Purdue was asking him to do. And he certainly was not going to get to the rim and score on Zach Edey. And, you know, when those shots went in, State had pretty darn good offense. Even when Barnes wasn't doing that much, he made it happen with that. So, no, he does not run an AAU offense. and they had a lot of other good stuff. Like, I put out an article that was like a glossary of everything that I'd seen them run like multiple times. Like, I've gone back now and watched through the tournament. There's like 7 new things that were in there that I hadn't noticed before, including my favorite one was against Texas Tech when they went Ram 77 with Horn as the first screener, which I had not seen them do all year. That was really fascinating, though. And I think he scored 5 points off the 2 times they ran that action. Like, it was really effective. And, you know, they did a good job. You do wonder maybe why that wasn't in there earlier. But, I thought they did a really excellent job playing to the strengths of their players.
Yeah, the reverse ball screen is a very trendy play right now. And that's one thing that everyone said going into it, that Marquette was going to kill them on, and ended up not. But it's been, you know, like, funny to see that narrative. And, you know, the narrative that comes out after State beat each one of these top teams is like, huh, you know, that team that normally shoots really well didn't shoot very well in that game, and that's why they lost to NC State, giving no credit to the defense that NC State played. But I just, you know, like I was saying earlier about just trying to, like, let this run sit on its own without thinking too much about next year. But that's just the general life of a sports fan of like mm-hmm. always, as soon as one season ends, you're thinking about the next year immediately. That's just human yep. nature and mm-hmm. trying not to think about what's going to happen in early January next year if they have like a 2-game losing streak, and you know, how are the vibes from this run going to last? You know, what's the expiration date on them? You know, because we know how people have a tendency to just like flip their lid every time like something goes wrong. But you know, I would hope that they would last like a little bit longer and give people the benefit of the doubt. One thing that's always been a thing with the two sides of the coin of the Kevin Keats tenure is people saying, just give him time, he'll figure it out. And the other side of people saying, he's had enough time, get him out of here. And now we have the extreme of the extreme example of saying, just give the team time to gel. Mm-hmm. Because now yeah. we know that it is possible that they can gel at the absolute last mm-hmm. moment. So people can't complain if a team full of transfers hasn't gelled by February. You can say, hey, yeah, there's still time.
Yeah. Well, I think it's funny that the Kevin Keats give him time and the Dave Doran give him time. We're kind of going on the same trajectory, at least mm-hmm. at one point where people were like, okay, it's time for Dave to go. And then Dave goes out and, you know, wins, beats Clemson. And we're like, oh, okay, we're good. You know, we're good now. and then, Keats has to go. We win the ACC. We go to the Final Four. So it's kind of really interesting to me how those have kind of the same, kind of different in the yeah, sense that absolutely. You know, both coaches have been given a lot of time, and we've talked about it before. You know, Dave Doran has to be the weirdest feeling person on the entire NC State coaching staff all around right now. I know we've talked about that before, but that actually leads into the next point, and that is that if we're excited about this basketball team, wait until they see what we're putting out there this fall. I mean, have you watched the highlights of this spring game? I am already excited, and they haven't played a real game yet.
That game was fun to watch. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's like a flag football game. You know, they're not going 100%. You know, it's a glorified practice, but
right.
it's those are some dudes, man, and I think. Just seeing, you know, the name Noah Rogers has been something State fans have been hearing for so many years.
The boogeyman.
To actually, yeah, he's literally like the boogeyman. Does he really exist? I don't know if this dude exists. And he was there on the field in an NC State uniform and helmet, catching passes. Yeah. And,
that throw from Grayson McCall to Noah Rogers, yes, it was slightly underthrown and Noah adjusted to it. But, yeah, chef's kiss, like
dude. The throws that Grayson McCall was making. It just like I cannot wait to see him throw the ball. And some of the little things that he was doing in that spring game are some of the things that I mentioned last fall, talking about Brennan Armstrong, about his tendency to tuck and run and just take off. And I would say a few times that I wish he would use his legs to stretch plays out, and he did a little bit late in the season during that winning streak. But McCall did it right away, where he stretched a play out and ran laterally along the line of scrimmage in order to throw the ball downfield. And I was like, yes, finally, they're doing the thing. And I hope that that's something that they continue to do.
Well, and Alec shared something with some people earlier about already... You basically said, was it on Twitter? You said that you said Robert's already getting weird and it's the spring game.
Oh god, that was sweet. The weird formations are already coming out of there. There was one. It was like they almost had two H-backs. Like they just put players wherever the hell they want. They're just like, hey, we're just gonna put like 17 guys over here, and that's what we're gonna. This is everything feels in place right now, does it not? I mean,
yeah,
you go back.
Weird.
You go back and you look at. The good state teams, especially the ones that were expected to be good, but really both, over the last handful of years. And, you know, you can always point to, like, something that really undid them. So you go back all the way to Ryan Finley years, right? That secondary basically was terrible. Frankly, it was horrible. You know, the Devin Leary teams couldn't really run the football. They didn't have a lot of guys that were good in space. They became a very one-dimensional offense. They were very dependent on... size mismatches at receiver, and you know, the ability to throw the ball downfield, and they built off of that. And they did a fine job doing it, but they were hamstrung in a number of ways. And obviously with 2022, you had other offensive issues there. You know, and then obviously last year they concocted up an offense that, you know, had so many issues early in the season and, you know, maintained those issues later on in the year, I thought, to some degree. You know, you mentioned Brandon Armstrong. Yeah, Brandon Armstrong is, to me, you know, he's an awesome player that I'm really happy played for State, and I thought he was great, but he's not nearly the polished passer that Grayson McCall is. This team's offense, I don't know where the hole is supposed to be. I don't know how you're supposed to stop them, you know, if they stay healthy, because they can do everything. This team can run the ball. These backs are good. Like, that is the thing that stood out to me from this game, is Jordan Waters is so polished as a running back. He was turning. So there's a lot of injuries on the offensive line, and I thought if you could point to one thing offensively that was bad, it was the interior of the offensive line run blocking. Had trouble maintaining the edge at some point, but Waters bailed them out 4 or 5 different times with really great second cuts. He's so patient, right? So it was like the first play of the game, I think. It might have been the second one. Run an outside zone read, and I don't remember who it was. I think it was the right guard. Had a big ask on the play. Had a lot of ground to cover to try and reach block with the nose tackle, I think it was. And he kind of got there. But, you know, Waters, you know, he got inside of him, right? The nose tackle was able to get outside and prevent him from reaching him. But he was able to throw him outside a little bit. And, you know, Waters makes the correct cut inside of that block, and he can't hold the edge. And the nose tackle spins around back into the gap. And Waters just basically stops and works around him. Like, and he probably should not have been able to do that. Most backs would not have been able to do that, you know, in the time and the space that he had available to him there. He's very patient. He sees things very, very well. He makes good cuts, and he's a physical runner. He's not the most explosive guy ever, but he is a physical runner, and he's very, very smart and polished running back. And he gets more than what's blocked for him. And then Dalen Smothers probably has some polishing left to do for sure, but that dude is a rocket. I mean, he is 100 miles an hour out of the gate. I mean, his potential is absolutely sky high. This is a team that's going to be run first. They're going to run the ball on you a lot. And I don't think you can match up with State one-on-one, you know, at receiver very often. You sure can't with Concepcion. I'm imagining it's going to be very hard to do that with Noah Rogers as well. But if you play zone against this team, you know, you have this, if the offensive line is going to play well, and I think it will, if you play zone against this team, Grayson McCall is such a polished passer, he's going to pick you apart. And he did in this game. He did.
Yeah.
You know,
I forgot I was on mute there.
Yeah, the third down plays where he saw a lot of cover three in this game, he shredded it. I mean, he shredded it. You know, it was, I mean, granted, it's the second unit, of course. But
yeah,
all those pieces are there. Like, you can beat basically anything anybody throws at you, you know, provided that the offensive line stays healthy. I do wonder about depth there a little bit. I know there's been some positive reports out of camp, but, you know, those always come with a grain of salt to me. You know, I think guys like Matt McCabe struggled in this game. I don't think that they had a great game to play backup offensive linemen. If you get the full unit out there, you know, they played so well at the end of last year. I really see this as a team that can score in so many different ways.
Yeah,
it's just really exciting.
I feel really bad for Western Carolina because that game could be 70-0 at halftime.
They're going to call like 4 plays the whole game in that game. It's going to be like inside zone, outside zone, and like, man, they had some funky counters and powers in this game that were awesome. Like a lot of same side power, which was something that they didn't run a whole lot of, I don't think, last year. A lot of same side power and counter in this game, which was fun to see. And I is getting deeper and deeper into the running game bag. And that's
really hope that one of the limitations isn't Dave Doran, his propensity to pull out enough to win versus just steamrolling people. You know, I want to see, the goal ought to be 35 points a game. That needs to be the goal, to score week in, week out. And that's, if you can do that while, you know, having an above average, it doesn't need to be as an elite defense, but just having an above average defense, then that is enough to win the conference. So, you know, we don't know what we're going to get out of Florida State, but I am confident based on the schedule, the way that it is, minus the Tennessee game, that just looking at the ACC games, that if you can get out of your own way in terms of being conservative up, you know, in the second half, just keep scoring, do what you have to do to put teams away, then, you know, sky's the limit. Yeah, like you're saying, Smothers is a guy that I've had my eye on for a long time, hoping that he would come, because he's like a microwave, and, you know, he can break off a quick run so easily. And the big knock against the receivers for several years until Concepcion showed up was, can any of these guys get open? Can they get themselves open outside of the scheme? And take your pick on which one of these guys is gonna be able to do that.
The slot fade that Rodgers ran on his biggest catch of the game, and that when he was in the first quarter.
And that's still hopefully he sticks around after McCall exhausts his eligibility, is CJ Bailey. And, you know, that guy's got all the potential in the world. You know, from the start of the game, he knocked off like a 50-plus yard run, and the touches he was putting on his passes, he's clearly raw, and he needs to continue to develop. And the guy was just in high school a few months ago. But
yeah, I think you're right about CJ Bailey. I think that, and I mentioned this before we started with Alec, but I think my biggest area of concern with this team is that Grayson McCall has had a couple of injuries the last couple of years. And if we run into that situation again, is Bailey polished enough? Is Lex Thomas, if we need it, polished enough to go out there and win us football games? And with the portal window opening again, I almost wonder if we need to go out there and get another veteran quarterback just to fill that void, you know? I mean, like we had with Brennan Armstrong and MJ Morris, kind of. Or like we had with Jack Chambers.
I mean, that's definitely the concern, because I think the answer is definitively no. You know, I think Assad said it well, that, you know, Bailey, you can definitely see the potential there, but very, very raw. He was all over the place accuracy-wise and read-wise in this game, which is, you know, to be expected with a true freshman. It's not anything other than what you would expect. But, you know, there's been some really positive reports from him. You know, I don't think he looked great in this game. Maybe he turns it on when he gets more comfortable. Possibly it could be. You don't know. But unfortunately, I really don't think you're going to go get a veteran quarterback at this stage of the game to come in, unless it's a guy like Jack Chambers who wants to spend a year in the program and then become a grad assistant, and that's his trajectory, because, you know, you get a 1 year guy to come be a backup, like, that's not going to happen. And then
I don't know what happened to that one quarterback that we were talking to from Appalachian State, but he would have been that kind of guy, right?
Yeah, no one wants to come in and be a backup for 1 year. That's not why you're leaving. So it's going to be tough. So you're right. I mean, health is going to be the thing here. And, you know, that's going to be the big thing, because Grayson McCall's a guy that can really move too. And I think they're going to want to run a lot of the zone read and a lot of the slide RPO that has the zone read component to it. And, you know, how much, you know, do you really want to put that guy in you know, a position to get his head taken off? You know, how much are you really willing to call a quarterback draw? So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what they do, how much they want to run him, basically, because you're right.
Well, I think the difference there is that, you know, with Brennan Armstrong is Brennan was not afraid to do that and was used to doing that. And I almost don't know if Grayson McCall is more of a pocket passer who can run, like a Trevor Lawrence, in the sense that Trevor Lawrence was not a mobile quarterback. He could run if he needed to, but he wasn't a mobile quarterback. I think that's what Grayson McCall should be.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who definitely can make plays with his legs, but he is not a human freight train like Brian Armstrong. I don't think you could physically injure Brian Armstrong. I think Armstrong could run through a GE locomotive, and he would have stayed on his feet. You know, McCall is not that type of runner. There's not many quarterbacks that are, especially not quarterbacks that aren't 6'6". Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean it'll be interesting. See how much that they put out there.
And what's really important to remember is Jonathan Paylor's not even enrolled yet.
I forgot about that. This is scary, man. Yeah. They're not even there yet. They got some weapons.
That's nuts. And it, you know, we talked about it when McCall first signed, and we had gone through the film and looking at the kind of stuff he was doing, the throws that he was making transcend the level of the conference that he was playing in. Those types of throws and those types of reads travel no matter the level of competition. Yes. And you saw it immediately in the spring game. And it's just the thing that jumps off the tape for me is just the timing of his passes, because it's a big difference of hitting guys in stride versus late or early, or, you know, he can make all the throws of the inside throws, the back shoulder stuff, all that stuff. You know, the amount of shots we're going to see downfield of him hitting Noah Rogers in stride, I can go to bed at night just dreaming about it.
Yeah, he can stretch the field. And that's stretching the field has somehow become like synonymous with arm strength, but it's in my opinion, more about accuracy down the field than it is about actually stretching the field physically. Like, how far can you throw the dang ball? That's where, to me, he's the most accurate is down the field. And the other component of him that, maybe not talked about enough is that he's good at the line of scrimmage. Like, he's good, pre-snap read, changing plays. He's advanced. Like, he can do those things. And, we talked about earlier, like, how do you defend a team that can score in so many different ways? Well, one of the answers to that is you just heat up the quarterback and you make him really uncomfortable and then tends to struggle. And I think McCall is a guy that can definitely deal with that. He's definitely a guy that can check out of plays and hit the hot routes and that kind of stuff. So, I think he's coming into this season a little bit overlooked nationally. I don't even know who's where anymore in the ACC, but mm-hmm. Is there a guy in the ACC that you think is comfortably better than McCall?
Cam
Ward at Washington State, maybe, or at Miami, maybe.
But
see, I said Washington State, knowing full he was at Miami because of this transfer portal, but.
But yeah. I mean, DJU did end up at FSU? Did that end? That
yeah,
end, did,
DJU is at FSU.
I put McCall above DJU, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with him.
Thinking back to like when Grayson McCall was in high school, like he was obviously a very good quarterback. Mm-hmm. And how did he end up at Coastal Carolina? I mean, or did he just develop into that kind of QB? I mean. He certainly seems like a guy that was really under-recruited. And I think, he was around the same time Sam Howell was, I think. Or maybe they were the same class, I don't know. But they were around the same time. And I know there was a lot of hype, because I was living in that area at the time. There was a lot of hype around Sam Howell, and nobody really seemed to pay attention to Grayson McCall. So, I wonder if maybe he was kind of under-recruited, almost. And that's how he ended up at Coastal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the level of the schools that were recruiting him. It's those kinds of guys fall through the cracks, I think. And it's, he was a two-star, I'm looking at it now, he was a two-star recruit coming out of high school. And he was, the number 80 dual threat quarterback in the country, it looks like, with a 77 rating. I mean, as a transfer to 247 Sports had him rated as a 4-star. So it just shows that guys can get overlooked. And, he had looks from Coastal Carolina, Army, Chattanooga, Eastern Kentucky, and Gardner-Webb. So it could also just be the school that he was playing at might not have been, high profile enough .
They're not a perennial power, unfortunately, and I apologize to any alums of Porter Ridge High School, but no, they're not a perennial North Carolina football
exposure. Exposure definitely has a lot to do with that. There's a lot of guys that will get recruited and they'll have no rating at all, and they will barely be in the system, and then they'll get an offer from like an NC State or someone in that range, and suddenly they'll be like an 88 Because, you know, it's just hard to rate that many players. The classic example is the
guys that tried to troll 24/7 Sports.
Oh my gosh, yes.
The fake player that said he got an offer from Alabama and all of a sudden he was a 4-star, like, overnight. And it was just a name on a page. The guy didn't exist.
Do you guys remember the player who tweeted out that he had gotten an offer from Northern Illinois? And the Northern Illinois coach saw the tweet and was like, "We did."
He had no idea who he was. That's always fun.
That's totally a thing now that guys are doing when they list their top tens, the Tipton edits and all that. They'll put the logos in the edit of the schools that didn't actually offer them, just to kind of raise their own clout to say, like, these are the teams that are in my top 10. Some of them never even talked to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we got to get to our question of the day this week, and we'll go back to the Final Four for a second, because we're going to keep it in the Final Four theme this week. And our question of the day this week actually comes to us from Twitter, and it comes from Joe Wagstaff, and he wants to know, what meant more to you as a State fan? Beating UNC in the ACC championship, or making the Final Four? And he says with the preface that not what was more important from a program building standpoint, but what meant more to you specifically. Let's have Alec go first on this one.
To me, it's the ACC championship, because they got to hold a trophy. It's, you know, I, definitely the Final Four meant more to the program, but for me personally, that is the demon destroyer. That is the monkey off the back more than going to the Final Four was. That is the thing that was, the ACC championship is something that allegedly existed, but I don't know. I believe that it was ever real, but it is real now. Beating UNC is like the cherry on top. It's kind of not as big of a deal to me. They're not really our rivals. It's more Duke, I think probably. I understand, though. Look, they haven't won a title since 2016. But I understand it's a tough neighborhood, and maybe they just need to find a little bit different way to approach basketball if they want to get there. But
this is going to be bulletin board material next season, isn't it? Oh, boy.
It is, but winning the title, you didn't lose. You didn't make it really far and then lose. Like, to me, like, that's different. You literally won the championship. So that is, to me, it's a much bigger deal. And they won 5 games versus 4. So you could even say that, it meant more for sure.
I think that has to be the answer. It's definitely the kind of thing that nationally, the profile, making the Final Four, it's something that they'll be able, they get to hang 2 banners next season, which is amazing. But that's the kind of thing that you can recruit off of a Final Four appearance. But the thing for me, I have always been a fan of the history of ACC basketball, what it represents. And it's something that's been watered down as these Big East teams have come in, and it continues to be watered down with these Pac-12 teams coming in and SMU. And we'll never see the version of the 9-team conference again, with the play-in game and the great weekend that had the TVs on the carts and all of that. You know, that ACC is gone, but that legacy still exists. And it's something that with every passing year seems to be a little bit more and more of a distant memory. But the dream of winning the ACC never went away for me. It was just something year in, year out that I just wanted them to do once. I literally just wanted to see it happen. And as I've lived away from North Carolina, it has been really hard for me to explain how much winning the ACC means within the state of North Carolina. And at least it used to. I don't know how much it does anymore. But just especially living in the Raleigh area and just being on top all the fans being on top of each other. And, you know, I just remember opening the newspaper when I was a kid, the weekend of the ACC tournament, and reading the breakdowns of all the teams and having that go through the years. Just like, you know, ACC basketball means something. And I don't know, it's really hard to put into words. Just like, I was really, really emotional when they made the Final Four, but not as emotional as I was when they won the ACC tournament. Like, it was like, it's been weeks now. It's been almost a month now since it happened. And it's just like, I just feel like the weather's been really crappy here in New Jersey, but I just feel like every day has just been sunny since that happened. And it's a literal weight, just for me personally, as a sports fan, has been lifted. Yeah. It's been like, I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine the other day, and I've been watching NC State week in, week out. I think this is my 25th year or 26th year of just consistently watching them. And I probably missed watching a dozen or less NC State basketball games over the last 25 years. I mean, is it literally, this is just what I do, is watch this team when they're in the bottom of the barrel versus trying to compete and just hoping that they would be able to put it together. And the comparisons that people were making about the ACC tournament being like a video game and stepping up one boss level after the other. And we talked about it after they won. It was like, if you were going to make the story of how to slay these demons, you had to do it in this order. And you can't use there's no more excuses of anybody from the outside saying that it can't be done, because they did it. And they did it in a way that's completely legendary. And those stories, this is our 83 run that we'll always have. And it's like, I'm just getting like caught up in the feelings about it, just explaining it now. And it's, you know, this is a lifetime memory.
Yeah. I think for me, I actually had a much more visceral reaction to making the Final Four than winning the ACC championship. Winning the ACC championship was awesome. I think it was just the shock of it all that it really never sunk in, because we went straight into this NCAA tournament run, and all of a sudden you blink and you're in the Sweet 16. And you're like, hey, we might have something here. Like, there might be something special to this. And I think that the Final Four run meant more to me because we proved that it wasn't a fluke, that winning the ACC tournament was not a fluke, that this team really did find another level. And really did. Yes, you want to win it. You want to raise the trophy at the end. And winning the ACC championship and getting that trophy is amazing. And I'll always remember that. And I'll always remember where I was, and who I was with, and, you know, the reaction to it. And that we got to beat Light Blue U to do it. But I think that I think going to the Final Four, just because I never, ever thought that either of those things would happen. But I most certainly never thought we'd go to the Final Four, ever. And to be able to not only beat Giant Killers game after game after game in the ACC tournament, but once you got through Texas Tech and Oakland, you had the 2 seed in Marquette, you had the 4 seed in Duke. I mean, you were beating good team after good team after good team. And to have to play Duke to go to the Final Four.
Your biggest rival.
It just felt like that's what changed my thought process on this. Was, yes, we beat UNC to win an ACC championship. We'll never have that taken away from us, and that's what's amazing. But we had to do it all over again against the other Triangle school just to get to something we also hadn't achieved in over 40 years. So I think, to me, that's what made it even special, was it was all over again. We had to do it, and we did it again.
Yeah, it was a validation. It was a validation of the other run, for sure. And the fact that you were able to beat Duke twice in a 2 to 3 week span showed, like you're saying, that it wasn't a fluke. You know, we've been doing our best to try and not talk about whether they'll be able to carry this forward in future seasons, and, you know, maybe he will, maybe he won't. You would like to think that he had some epiphany about how to manage a program more than the X's and O's. he was able to manage the emotions of that run and have them stay locked in from game to game. And that was really amazing to see. I didn't know that Kevin Keats had that in him, not so much as whether he was or wasn't a good game manager, a strategic basketball coach, but able to keep the locker room locked in like that with, you know, nobody believes in us, the whole mantra, and we're just going to go focus on the next game and the next game, survive in advance. And, you know, you would hope that that is a legitimately educational experience from him of how to do it, you know, and he doesn't have to follow anybody else's blueprint in order to repeat it, to do it again. He can do it himself. I would love to be able to win the ACC championship as a top four seed. So that shows that you can make a great run or make a deep run in the NCAA tournament and not have the cloud overall of the storyline be, oh, this is a great Cinderella run. Who would have believed it? I want to be able to make that run of saying, everybody believed that we could do it, and then we did it. I want them to become that team. I've always wanted them to see that. But, you know, this apart from that, you know, this, it's, you know, you could take a pick.
Yeah.
We do have one more Twitter question that came through from Dylan Laws that says, While we've all been distracted by the good times, got any insight into what the heck is happening to the team over at Doak Field? I think we have to have our friend Cal Parker back on to talk about what's now a 5-game losing streak, I believe, for the baseball team. But
that might be a not as pleasant addition.
We'll probably get into that last time. we'll get him back on the show and we'll talk a little more baseball here soon, I think. But it's a lot easier to deal with when you're coming out of two Final Fours at the same time. And Grayson,
I almost wonder if they've kind of been given the bad juju, if you will.
The baseball team?
Like football started the good times. Now basketball's got the good times, but baseball is still kind of stuck in that 2021 College World Series issue rut that they can't get out.
They're the most cursed sports team I think I've ever watched. I mean, there's just so much. I mean, the one that sticks with me more than any other one, even more than the 2021 College World Series, is that Coastal Carolina game where they had to, was it Cody Beckman, I think it was, that was quit throwing unhittable baseballs. And then he walked to do what?
Andrew Beckman.
I'm sure I got the name wrong. I don't remember.
He was the one that also played basketball, right?
Are you talking about Andrew Brackman from like 15 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Wrong
everything there. Anyway, yeah. Yeah. That's all.
It's been a long day.
But yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't know. If I had to pick, you know, obviously, like we said, it had to be basketball. It means more, but you know, it's they can fly under the radar. The fact that we didn't even know, I had the spring game kind of circled on my calendar, and then totally forgot it was happening, and you know, now I'm still going to go into the fall, still thinking about basketball, and that's a great feeling to have that we can.
Not spend
the whole time just looking forward to football.
I think I'm going to be really excited for football, though, just because I know what the pieces that we have offensively, and I think that just makes it really exciting. And you know that if for some reason we go out there and we beat Tennessee and we beat Clemson and we're sitting there 4-0, then somebody has done something to NC State where everything can go right.
And you can thank him for
DJ Burns.
DJ Burns. Can we get DJ Burns to sound the siren for game 7 of the Stanley Cup final if the Canes make it there and host?
He's absolutely gonna be there. He's gonna break that siren and the lid's gonna fly off of PNC. And
maybe not even game 7. Maybe if it's just the first playoff series. Whoever they play in the playoffs, the first game. Can we just have DJ do it and then just have the mojo carry over the rest and sweep their way to a cup.
We've had several years in a row now where we've been at this point in the calendar and really looking forward to football because of the considerable recurring success of the program. But we haven't had a point where it's been April and we're already looking forward to the next basketball season. And I can't remember the last time that that's happened. And we're going to have a really good feeling in October, I think, if what we think is going to likely or hopefully, knock on wood, happen with the football team, and then basketball is going to be happening at the same time. And, you know, hopefully they can schedule some higher quality, not out of conference opponents. But, you know, it's going to be fun come like October, November, when we're when I have both sports to cover.
Well, hopefully everyone will have good times and excitement and feeling about listening to our next episode of the Lotcast. We appreciate you listening to this one, and we will be back next time to talk more. But now we're kind of getting to that situation. Like, what are we going to talk about?
DJ Burns.
Let's get DJ on here. I mean, seriously, let's do it.
And then we'll just keep talking about Pop-Tarts.
Okay. Yeah. We need to have that Pop-Tarts movie watch party. Like that should be something we actually do. And Alec and Asad can just sit there and arguing about raw Pop-Tarts back and forth the whole time. Like,
great summer content.
Oh yeah. Well, that actually is going to wrap this one up. Thanks for listening, everybody, guys. Thanks as always. And we'll see you next time, and go Pack.
Pack.